Yin to the other's gang, two sisters, both curious and strange. A likely duo and they witty from the brain. It's the magic hour, Mercedes and Jay.
Greetings, boys and babes. It's the Magic Hour, a place where we navigate through life's peaks and valleys with all the vulnerability and shamelessness we can muster. With the help of world-class guests from all walks of life, we uncover new truths and valuable tools for manifesting our highest potential. I'm your host, Mercedes Terrell, along with my partner in shine, Jade Bryce.
Hey, you guys. So today's guest is someone I've been trying to get on for a really long time, so I'm super stoked the day has come. She is by far my favorite Instagram account to follow, and if you follow me, you probably see her post in my stories a lot because I share them almost daily.
Yes, I think, Jade, you and I send them to each other daily, too.
Yeah, sometimes the same one.
So much wisdom and knowledge shared there, and we can't wait to share it here with you guys as well. So it's truly an honor. Let's get her on, Jade.
Yes, without further ado, let me introduce the founder of the Mindful Healing Center in Philadelphia, where she works with individuals, couples, and families to heal issues around gut health, sleep, movement, cellular health, belief, and mindfulness as part of her treatment. She evolved her more traditional training from Cornell University to also acknowledge and include the connection between the mind and body. As both a clinical and holistic psychologist, she views mental and physical struggles from a whole person perspective and works to identify the underlying physical and emotional causes. A healer through and through, with even her social media presence shedding so much light on us and the world, we couldn't be more excited to be speaking with her today. Please welcome Dr. Nicole LePera to the show.
Thank you both, Jade and Mercedes, so much for having me. I'm beyond honored and really excited to have a chat and to connect with your audience.
Yeah, thanks. We're excited too. I want to kick this off by getting your side of, your story about the journey you took from conventional psychology to holistic psychology.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting because my journey was both personal in that realm in terms of psychology and mental wellness and professional. So I'm someone on the personal end of things who has had anxiety for as long as I can remember. I was the little girl afraid of, you know, catastrophes happening to my family. So it's really all I knew. Upwards into about probably my early 20s when I was living in New York City. I was just starting my training program. I had some health things happening in my family and my anxiety completely spiked it might as well have been one panic attack after another. So long story short, I entered into, you know, I did what I thought I had to do, being in the field, but also I think the messages. I went and I got the talk therapist and I clocked many hours sitting on a couch, you know, exploring what was going on for me in terms of my anxiety. And I was on medication and when I sought out a psychiatrist. So taking very much the traditional approach, I was managing, as I would call it, my anxiety, but it never really went away. I was in training, you know, learning similarly. I was going to be the talk therapist at the same time. So flash forward, I got to a point in my training where I was able to move from New York City to Philadelphia, where I live now, and hang my own shingle and start my own practice. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, I was still struggling in many of the same ways. My anxiety was better, but there. I could go to the brink of panic. I might not have the full panic attack that I would have had in the past, but it was still present in my life. And I was still finding myself in my relationships, in my world, finding myself up against the same patterns, things that weren't working, even though at this point, I felt like I was gaining so much insight in myself. I knew, you know, what I needed to do differently, and yet I wasn't. Started to realize, this is where it kind of spans then professionally, started to realize the same patterns that were happening in my clients. And at this point, I was logging hour upon hour, week after week, inwards of a couple years with same things. Symptoms still there, not really all fully gone. Same patterns, great insightful session. Oh, way to go. See you next week. Oh, that same fight with my boyfriend or my partner happened. Oh, I did that same negative, you know, behavior to cope with it. Anyway, long story short, for some reason, I know why now. I think nutritionally, I started to have really scary physical symptoms myself. Some of them were becoming evident in my sessions with clients. I was forgetting names. I was fainting at home. I never fainted before. I got really scared. And of course, my anxiety spiked again. I'm like, what? Clearly it was that, you know, no jokes aside, but I thought there was something legitimately wrong with my brain. And my fear propelled me into my own personal research. Mm-hmm. At this point, I'm so grateful for the world of online because I was introduced to a whole new world of information about gut health and epigenetics. Our genes aren't our destiny, about the subconscious, the reason why I was finding myself repeating those patterns, despite the incredible amount of insight that I had come to have on myself, et cetera, et cetera. So I started to change things in my life on a personal level. I changed my nutrition. I changed my lifestyle. I changed how I slept. I changed how I dealt with stress. Mm. I started to explore this subconscious world of mine, and I started to get better in such a way that I had not been seeing or I had not experienced personally and in my practice, which brought me online. I was like, okay, where am I going to go with these tools now?
Yeah.
I knew that they were working for me. I knew that they were working with my partner. She too is someone who has extensive anxiety, but I didn't know if it went beyond that. So intuitively, you know, social media became my outlet. Okay, let me talk about some of the struggles that I was having and the success that I'm having. And a couple months in, I was blown away because I started to get messages from people. I would talk about what I would do to heal, how I changed my nutrition, how I worked on breath work, consciousness, everything I was doing, I was talking about. And I started to get messages trickling in where people are saying, oh, I'm doing this too, and I'm feeling better. So now I started to realize I have to take a look at this holistic way of treating a human. If these people are affecting change in their life without even sitting in front of me, there has to be something here that can be harnessed for the people in front of me. And at that point, I did a really big pivot professionally. So I say that because it really was an intersection of my own personal healing journey that brought it into my clinical work. I decided that I really need it to, and I think all practitioners start looking more holistically. Yeah. And I started to do just that.
Yeah.
Do you notice it's like, notice it's like the same with most people, like anxiety is linked to gluten or sugar, or is it different for everybody?
There's a lot of similar contributing factors. So when I word it the way I work now holistically, so we take the whole person. So in the body, what I'm concerned around, especially with anxiety, is resolving any underlying physiological imbalances that some food items, glutens, things like that, processed sugar, processed oils, things like that, could be causing some damages that could result in those physiological imbalances in our gut. We now know our gut plays a really pivotal role.
Yeah.
With the anxiety, depression too is another one that's very strongly linked. We're starting to believe that depression is an inflammation in our brain that slowed cognition. All of the symptoms are actually upstream damage from that originates in the gut. So I look at sleep. I think sleep is underrated and underutilized. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially because for a lot of us, depressions and anxieties and the symptoms that we're experiencing are affecting our sleep quality, our sleep amount. So, you know, looking at anything that can balance our body, I do think is a common factor in a lot of the symptoms that people are struggling with. And then there's the subconscious part of our mind that I know is a stuck point for even those of us
rewiring.
Who don't have the symptoms. Yeah, if we just find ourselves not having satisfying relationships, or relationships are a playground for our subconscious and all aren't helpful anymore. Just finding ourselves up against the same, you know, hurdles time and time again, and using not helpful ways to navigate them is really evidence of that subconscious. So I think those core tenets are really do apply pretty universally. Some people I'll work with have more of the need to balance their body. Some people are more of the need to balance their mind in a sense, or create a new conscious self from that.
But there's always some sort of gut mind.
Yeah.
Connection.
100%. It is interconnected. And just as much as the mind affects the body affects the mind, as I see it. I don't believe that there's going to be a reality of the future where I actually think, and I lightheartedly joke, but I hope this is the case, that this time in history where the two were separate is going to be one of those times in history where people are like, what the hell were they thinking?
Right.
How the hell could this be separate? You know, I'm hopeful that we get there. I think that honestly, the success I had no expectation when I went online. I had no idea what that was going to be. I just wanted as an outlet, you know, the knowledge that I know is not out there for most of us as practitioners, let alone as humans. My hope is that this, and I think the growth of my account is emblematic of people being ready for it. And honestly, I have a lot of practitioners. I was unsure of how my peers were going to react when I started to put this information out there, but it's been wholeheartedly welcomed. I have a lot of people that I actually see now for professional mentorship sessions that want these tools as well, because they have had similar observations in their practice. It's just not working until you consider the whole being in front of you.
I think people too are getting tired of being dismissed by their Western medicine practitioners, you know, immediately like, oh, you don't fit into these boxes, then you're fine. Nothing's wrong with you. And it's like, dude, something's wrong. I'm sitting here telling you, and you're not going to look any further into it. It's real frustrating. And then we're doing our own work on the web, or we go and find you, you know, or whatever it is. But I wanted to bring it back a moment and just touch on how you said when you moved from conventional psychology to holistic psychology, that it took this like hitting rock bottom in order to make that move. And I think that's another interesting point of how the human brain works. We have to get to that place.
Why? Yeah.
Be so afraid or be so detrimentally ill to finally make a move forward.
Yeah, I agree. And I've said this, I've observed this, put it that way, about humans for a while now. I did a lot of early work in my training around substance use and obviously change and things like that around, you know, wanting to stop those behaviors. And I started to realize that, I mean, that rock bottom statement is prolific in that field. Yeah. You know, even the people that are in recovery will talk about their rock bottom, use that exact language. Mm-hmm. And I started to look at that, and my understanding has always been, we need desperately, we have to feel so desperate that we cannot, this is a very simplified way to put it. Simplify things like, but we have to feel that we cannot tolerate life as it currently is to feel motivated to make a change. Because, and I talk about change often, because with holistic healing tools, I'm always the bearer of this not so welcomed piece of information, which is they're not the magic elixirs. These are not even the things that we can use as needed, or when we, you know, really just, we only want to use them, you know, in that moment. Right. We have to develop a consistency. We have to change our lifestyle in some ways. We have to integrate these consistently into our day, so that then when we really need them, these are really effective, in addition to the fact that we're building in this balance that I think as most of us humans, we need. But with that said, you'll also often, always, I should put, hear me talk about the challenge of change, that as I say it, is a universal human. So back to this, why don't I change? I think for two reasons. The threat of the unknown. Our brain does not, it actually does view it as a threat. I use that word, you know, kind of very strategically, because when we don't know, when there's a question mark and we don't know what this change will feel like or how it'll be or what'll come on the other side of this change, it, our brain interprets that as threatening to be avoided. Even though logically, you know, you and me, and we all might sit here and be like, no, logically these changes are going to get me to this goal that I want.
Right.
For our subconscious, it's threatening. It's unknown, and it would prefer the familiar that it already understands.
Just so, like anything foreign, we're afraid of it.
Everything. That's the thing. And we throw it. And then we, some of us actually get a threat-based, and then those of us who for sure have experienced any version of trauma, not only even big T trauma, I expand my definition of trauma, that trauma can be a consistently unmet need, not being seen or heard. Right? There's so many ways.
I think you posted.
Yeah, there's so many ways. Because I think, and this used to be me, I had a really hard time understanding why I was struggling in the ways that I was struggling. Because logically, when I look back, I didn't check any of those big boxes. I didn't see the big cataclysmic, you know, events that peppered my past experience that were the reason why. I now, with a different set of awareness, understand I had many underlying low level, consistent reasons why. But I think as society, most of us look for the big things that we know. And when we don't have that, it's confusing with why we're stuck in the ways that we're stuck.
And so, speaking of stuck, how do we move those emotions through our body? How do they get stuck in the first place in our body and mind?
So I believe, I like that you even said through our body, because the simplest way, when I talk, I very much simplify things, but I define very simplistically emotions as just that. They're energies that are moving through our body with the goal to be, you know, processed, as you will, essentially to move in, have the feel that they offer, and then they move away, and then we're done. That's what processing is. It's this elusive concept, but that's simply put the way that I see it. So there's a lot of ways that they become stuck. So when we are children, and we get to, you'll all often hear me describe us little beings. I don't know how you believe we get to this planet, however it is we get there. I will describe us in two ways, even as very little beings. We are intuitive and we are adaptive. So we have an inner guidance system that I believe we retain our whole entire life. Some of us just become disconnected or distrustful of it, and we adapt. And this is what applies here. So as children, if we are not given the experience. And we have to remember, anytime I talk about childhood, I acknowledge is truth. We are humans raising humans. Mm-hmm. So the caregivers that each of us had or were born into are limited to the extent of what they know and what they provide themselves. So mm-hmm. I say that because a lot of times, as I see it, many of us did have lacks in our environment, in our early caregiving. It's only natural. It's very hard to consistently show up and to show up for a child outside of yourself if you were not given the tools, if no one did that for you. And I know that a lot of the older generations that produced, you know, the humans that we are, and then they weren't given those tools. So if you're not being seen, heard, accepted as just a unique being in your childhood, if you don't have someone helping you regulate from the very earliest level, your nervous system. I mean, that's what we're doing when a child is crying. We're co-regulating. So an adult nervous system is teaching the child's nervous system to come back down to calm. If you don't have as an attentive of a caregiver who's either not present at all or is not attuned to your need in those moments or can't regulate themselves. So your cryingness as an infant is sending them
mirroring
their own, right? You're going to be very limited to soothe yourself then as an adult. And unfortunately, you're going to carry that with you unless you consciously treat or regulate, develop the ability to regulate your nervous system yourself.
Right.
So one of the tools I always talk about to that extent is breath work, is learning how to navigate that active nervous system that a lot of us have.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And then when I say adaptive too, I also mean if you didn't have someone, aside from when you're a crying infant, helping you understand your emotions, giving them language, teaching you how to soothe them or just be with you in them, you're going to adapt. We all have tools. We all have the thing that we do. And again, in a very simplified way, it looks, these are the two really general categories. I go outward and I react, you know, when my feelings come up, I discharge them everywhere. I fall into this latter category, or I numb, I detach, I dissociate. Mm. Right. And a lot of times we look very childlike in those moments because we're using that tool that we actually did develop as that child, wherever we were developmentally, when no one was helping us to do differently. So I say that because I think the reality is we all have tools. It's about modifying or getting an extra toolkit.
Yeah. I grew up in a really chaotic household where there was a lot of abuse and drug addiction, all forms of abuse. And I wanted to talk about addictive emotions with you because I'm curious if maybe my brain, or if our brain releases a chemical when we're stressed. And then now, you know, I'm a single mom of two toddlers, and my main concern is that everything to me has a sense of urgency to it. And the thing that bothers me most is that I don't want to put that on my children because I'm always rushing them now. Like, we gotta, let's go. And I'm wondering if maybe I have this addiction to stress where, you know, I don't know if it could be a tool, like you said, maybe I need to be better at time management. But for me, I'm wondering if it's a chemical thing.
I'm really happy, and thank you for sharing all of that, Jade, because this is really going to be beautifully illustrated. A very similar experience that I had, and I'll talk a little bit about what I mean when I say emotional addiction. It also piggybacks on why change is hard. Mm-hmm. So just stepping back into the subconscious for a second, because this is going to lead into exactly what you're describing here. And I think a lot of us have this experience. So our subconscious, as crazy as it sounds, it literally blows my mind every time I speak it, has logged everything that's happened to us thus far in life. And we'll continue to do that until we're no longer on this planet, which is a whole hell of a lot of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So it's categorized it. And the reality of it is, us as humans are very habitual creatures, from our just daily habits that we tend to repeat more consistently than not, to the thoughts that we think, to the feelings that those thoughts then induce in our body. So I describe it, I says our subconscious, each of us has a little avatar memorized us in there. So when I say change is hard, and it's going to lead into this kind of drive, this emotional addiction component. What happens when we go to do something new, even though we all agree logically, all of these great new, whether it's a habit or this affirmation or this new way I want to feel in the world, it's all going to get me this goal that I want in life. The second we go to implement and take the step to initiate that new routine or maintain it, or to affirm a new thought, think a new thought, right? Or to have a new emotion. So for you, peace, slowing down. The second we try to do that, our subconscious is very black and white. It registers things in a very dichotomous way. With, again, back to this idea of threat. Mm-hmm. The one end of the spectrum is familiar, safe, good, very simplified. The other end is unfamiliar, possibly threatening, bad, to be avoided at all costs. Mm-hmm. And then one of two things happen. It either produces mental chatter, which is simply an endless reason, litany of reasons why not to ever do this thing again and to abandon, jump ship right now, if not sooner. Or some of us get this other piece of it. Some of us start to feel physiologically or agitated in our bodies. I've heard it described as, I get a little bit of this. I get an energy that I can't describe. Some of us will say it's, I'm crawling out of my skin. Some of us will just feel weird. Oh, we don't feel like ourselves. Mm-hmm. Another perfectly great reason that our subconscious is offering us to go right back into that memorized comfort zone. So for you, Jaden, this has happened for me. Logically, and here you are logically saying, I don't want to pass this on to my children. Mm-hmm. I know chaos. So thinking about what your subconscious knows, a chaotic experience, complete with the hormones, the stress hormones that are released when we're in an overactivated nervous system. Mm-hmm. They're stress hormones, they're cortisol, there's adrenaline. Your body's actually changed now physiologically. Mm-hmm. So similar with me, I had a very chaotic upbringing, small things where my partner actually had to break it to me a couple years into our relationship when she told me, nothing ever happens in your family. Yeah. And I'm like, my mouth dropped open, my brain like started, I was like, what do you mean? Because all it ever felt like my whole life is a catastrophe, and I'm not like, because the way it was reacted to. So similar to you, a lot of chaos, different reason, different cause, but a lot of chaos. A lot of it was health related. I have a chronically ill mother and older sister, so there's a lot of points in time to feel chaotic and to feel stressed, right? So logically, if you would ask me, just like you're saying to me, I wanna do this for my children. I don't want them to feel this way. Me, all I would say is I want peace. I want calm. That's all you would hear me say. Desperately, I want to say.
Yeah.
Flash forward to a moment of peace and calm when I was not, you know, I'm living separately from my family. You know, I'm in a Zen-like experience. I would notice that would happen internally. I would start to find the thing to worry about because that's what I was used to feeling. Mm-hmm. And I add the physiological piece because what I would start to feel is that agitation. Mm-hmm. Either I feel like I had to do something to get it out, or I would agitate my partners and whoever I was with at the time. And then I'd be fighting and then I'd have something. Mm-hmm. So when I say addiction, that's what I mean. It's just familiar. So some of us are similar to, I think you and I, maybe those listening, have an addiction, really just a pull toward a familiar feeling, likely one that you've experienced predominantly in your older relationships, maybe your caregiving childhood environments that make even change toward a logical other end of the spectrum that we desire and want uncomfortable on some level. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think it plays out in my life too. Noticing that whenever I'm stressed, I want the other people around me on board with that stress in essence. And not just like, I'm not necessarily blatantly starting a fight, but my stress energy and being like, this needs to be done and this needs to be done and all these things need to happen. Mm-hmm. And that starts stressing everyone else around me. And I guess it's because I want to live in that chaotic space.
Mm-hmm. Is the solution to be just to start being conscious of it then?
My always number one suggestion is to practice daily self-observation. Mm-hmm. Practice whether or not you're developing it in a sitting meditation practice that allows you to do it during the day. Mm-hmm. Regardless, getting yourself to be internally or practicing a new way of viewing yourself in the world, which is also incorporating the endless thoughts that are in our day and painting our experiences. So change does not, I always simplify change into two steps. The first step being that consciousness or that awareness. Mm-hmm. And the second step being actioning, changing, doing something different. Mm-hmm. And both steps are integrally important, but step two doesn't happen unless we're practicing that consistent awareness. Yeah. What that means is noticing that pattern in yourself. Yeah. So if the thought is inducing an agitation in that moment, the quicker you're intentionally, that's another muscle that we're developing when we are practicing what I view as the most impactful tool of meditation change, which is mindfulness-based meditation. Mm-hmm. I'm separate from my thoughts, I'm viewing them objectively and I'm learning to pull my attention away from them, because more attention is just keeping it stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's not going to help any of us. So after we practice that consciousness and I start to see, quote unquote, how often those thoughts are coloring how I'm reacting or feeling about the world, then I start to have the tools to implement change, which is sometimes removing our attention, sometimes giving us a new toolkit on how to soothe that feeling. Mm-hmm.
Mm. So when we're in these moments of stress addiction, is it something you can liken to other addictions that potentially we use to block out what we actually need to take care of, or what our subconscious actually needs to, what we need to
form of numbing
subconscious. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I guess the other question on that end is, is it also related to victim mentality, you know, having a victim mentality or choosing not to forgive somebody or
world so, or something? Yeah, of course. So So what I want to say is two things. So the thing about victim mentality, and I think this maps right in to consciousness. So I like to use a simple description. I know victim mentality is a very loaded word. The way I define that is this. So before we get eyes on our internal world, right, on the way that our thoughts are coloring our experience, what we believe happens in our world day to day, moment by moment, is again very simplified. Something happens in the world, I feel some kind of way, and then I do that kind of thing. Typically the thing that I always do when I feel that kind of way, whether it's happy, sad, glad, mad, whatever. What we come to realize when we practice this internal self-observation is what really happens throughout our day is thing happens in the world, same thing. I've ran it through a filter. I've interpreted it to mean something. I've applied a meaning to it. Typically, this is based in an accumulation of my past experiences. Not always are there helpful models and beliefs, and you know, there's pain in there.
For sure.
That's what's contributing or resulting in that emotional reaction and then that reaction that then follows, right? Mm-hmm. So while I think, so version A, we are understandably feeling the way I call it is reactive to our environment because mm-hmm. we are. Mm-hmm. When the world is showing up with roses, we're okay. And when it's not, we're not okay. And we're right. riding a roller coaster of the world then. That's mm-hmm. not an empowered place to be, but it's natural. We have no other way to feel about it because we are reacting to the world because mm-hmm. we don't feel we're part of the equation. Mm-hmm. We think that our partner is causing us to feel this or our mm-hmm. family is causing, or the promotion that I didn't get is causing me to feel this way. Mm-hmm. But what's really causing us when we become self-aware is the meaning I assign to what happened or didn't happen in my life. Yeah. So while that's uncomfortable, it switches us from reacting to the world or a victim mindset of the world to one, a person, a being that has a say now. Yeah. And I believe that all empowerment starts with choice. So now we can make an intervention. We can choose whether or not that meaning actually applies to our current situation. Because a lot of us are applying meanings that don't. And to wrap back around to the first question about the distractive nature of stress too, as I don't know how this sounds when I say this, but our thoughts can be a source of welcome distraction for a lot of us as well. Mm-hmm. So stress, that which I'm used to in a sense, if it's familiar as it is for many of us, that might be preferred mm-hmm. than what's below mm-hmm. stress. Maybe not even related to the stress, right. but what's the deeper stuff down
yeah.
there. So to wrap back around, the question is, you know, are we distracting ourselves away? Sometimes this, I also see this come out a lot in productivity, an endless to-do list. Because on the one hand, we're very much validated. I know I was this. I am very validated in the world, you know, when I check my boxes. I mean, shit, I went to school longer than most humans, you know, or, you know, I mean, the school and the PhD and all this, and I got all of this great feel
checklists
good.
Checklists are done,
you know? I mean, talk about endless checklists, you know what I mean? So a lot of us, and there's a balance. Obviously, I believe that us humans are capable of pretty much anything creatively. We can create any life that we want. Mm-hmm. However, I do know that a lot of us use productivity, whether or not it's on the deepest level to feed a sense of self-worth or to distract it. I know for many years, when I look back at the timeline of my dips, if you will, before I got to my really low point, it was probably mapped on to when I didn't have that focal point for my attention. Mm-hmm. Summers, things like that, years off between school, when I didn't have the things to be worried about, up came all the other crap. I didn't like it, so I activated myself right out of that feeling.
Yeah, I think close friends that I feel like have been going through mm-hmm. that type of cycle where when they're busy, they suddenly feel okay. And when they're not busy, all these things mm-hmm. are popping up for them that they're not sure how to deal with or don't have the tools yet to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this too. I have a really close friend of mine who I don't know what's going on in her body or brain, but it seems whenever she's really busy, she's feeling better inside herself, you know. But when she's not, she is seeing every doctor on the planet and trying to figure out what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me. And do you see that often in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this piggybacks something like you were saying before. There's two what's wrong with me is that I see a lot. Right? There's the very intuitive one where we were talking about earlier. I know something's off and I'm not sure what it is, or I'm not getting the information, the clarity, the what next to fix it. Like I said earlier, we're intuitive beings. We never lose sight touch of that. So some of us, that's what's speaking. The part of side of us that knows that something's off. Even if the person in the white coat is telling us we're fine, go do this, it's in our mind, we know deeper.
Something's off, yeah.
We know something's off. The other, I think, path to something's wrong is, again, that endless searching. Sometimes a lot of us, I come from a family of this, so within the system of chronic illness of my mom and my sister, there was an endless reliance on something outside of me fixing it. Yes. Again, in a very general way, I'm putting this, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's the diagnosis that, and again, I'm never one, I do believe that to some extent, even though I have all my thoughts on diagnoses and DSM, which are for another conversation, right? I do believe that we can feel a relief when we have a name to what it is. So that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the drive to have something external provide, again, a very simplified way, a feel better of any kind, whether it's the sympathy or people knowing that something's actually wrong. So we now have, you know, the thing that says it is, and or what we have to do next. But again, I see sometimes we localize that outside of ourselves, and then we go on this endless search, because not to say the most cliched thing in the world, but here it goes. The answers all are in here. We're not, even if there's something actually wrong that can maybe be verified with a test, ultimately, I believe that it's up to us to navigate how we're going to navigate life with that being the case and not being fully reliant. Although I understand some things do need medications and this and that. I'm never going to say, F it all, don't, you know, we have to navigate our illness or our struggle or whatever it is our own way. But I think we are most empowered when it starts from within first.
I totally agree. And it's hard to communicate that to someone who's not, you know, ready, I guess, for it, or however you want to say they're not on that part of their journey. So all you can do is support them and hold space when they're around and, you know, and be a friend. But yeah, I mean, bringing it to that idea of dis-ease in the body, you know, it being somewhere where we're uneasy in our own minds, especially, or something that's rooted in our childhood trauma, and that creating the actual disease, you know, like we would call it in Western medicine, that can only maybe be fixed to a small degree with something external. The rest has to be done completely internally. So that's something really close to home for me. So thank you for exploring that with us. I want to ask you about the different aspects of ourselves and our ego. Maybe you could just highlight that for us, because I've heard you talk about it before.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I think this ego word is one of them that has taken on a kind of societal-based meaning. And typically, I think what comes to mind when most of us think ego is a negative connotation, right? It's this pompous, self-assured, holier-than-thou, you know, way of being. I think that's pretty generally what most of us call to mind when we think of that concept. So with that said, I think what follows is a lot of us think we're striving to get rid of it entirely and to not show up in that way in the world. But my view of what ego is a bit different. I view ego as something that universally all experience and likely will continue to experience. So it's not about eradicating our life of ego, because I actually see it as having fulfilled at a very early time of our life, and what it believes continuing to fulfill, a protective function, right? So to put it really simply, we come here as children and we are given, some of us very direct and some of us indirect, messaging on, again, very simplified language, what's appropriate or okay in the world and what's not okay in the world in terms of attributes, ways of being, things that we do or don't do. We're told, we're guided. Mm. And if we're not guided as directly in our family, before we know it, we're finding ourselves in a school system where we're definitely, so things are positive, you know, positively rewarded or reinforced, and then other things are disowned or told or shamed. I mean, we're even shamed, some of us, based on certain aspects or responses that we're giving to the environment. So that's what ego is. It's a separateness that has learned through the adaptive quality that we all are as children, how to present ourselves in the world in the most socially acceptable way. They're aimed at gaining recognition or validation. Some of it aimed at inclusion and connectivity and love and these deeper emotions that I think as humans we all desperately want. And to some extent, we are social creatures. You'll always hear about me speaking what I believe our goal is, interdependence, which means separate independence, but with the aspect of social creatures. We're going to have relationships in our life. That's how we survive. This is how tribes, you know, were rested places for us. It helped alleviate some of the stress of life, in addition to just the practicality. And that's the reality of human beings. So I don't think we're striving for, you know, woman, man, you know, whomever, alone on an island separate. We're striving for that interdependence. So we've learned at a young age how to ensure those feelings get met to the best of our ability. So another, very hot connection or hot concept connected to this concept of ego that you'll hear talked about now, which is really cool, which is shadow self. So that applies to, so what the shadow is all the stuff that we've been shamed or have come to believe is shameful about ourselves that we don't want to appear. So what we do is then we start to project, right? We start to see aspects of this shadow in others and we respond very negatively. We become triggered in some way. What the ego seeks to do at its core is two things: protect us, but protect us furthermore by keeping us separate and safe. So it thinks, from others. So if I can feel myself as different than you, I can feel safe within myself. And it's really, I think, a deterrent from feeling fully in everyone around us, and from being, and you know, part of the collective, as we're often talking about it now. So when we talk about ego work, first and foremost, it's important to notice when we're reacting from that ego place. You know, anytime we're feeling emphatic about something, or we're feeling triggered to speak our mind, you know, really loudly and get someone to understand our point of view to this thing, right? Chances are, you know, that might be coming from that more ego protective place. So there's something below the scene for me in that moment that I'm trying to protect myself from, or a way that I want to be perceived in the world by this person in front of me, defending against something. So a little, I wrote a, if anyone's interested, I do have a blog, and I wrote a long piece on ego work where I outline some of these steps, but a little fun thing that I was doing, and a couple people have kind of found a lot of success in this, is naming our ego, you know, and identifying like, oh, that's, you know, so mine is Jessica. So I can throughout my day know, oh, that was Jessica. She loved it in that way. So she came out with a really passive comment that she liked, right? So we start to learn the pattern of our ego, something helpful. I think just being aware of it and redefining it for what it is, which is not a negative thing to be eradicated, but a protective and understanding what it's coming from. And then, as all things, giving ourselves a bit of a tool to navigate it differently.
It's so interesting that ego, you know, it's at a primal nature. Yeah, it's there to protect us, but also there to, because we're tribal beings, to get us to be part of this tribe and community, but it seems to be also the thing that pushes everyone away from us. So it's like, I can't win with it or without it, you know?
Well, that's the thing. And I don't think we are going to have a life without it.
Sure.
But I bring this up because I think a lot of us, because we're using that other definition, which doesn't feel so good, you know, in the world, I do think a lot of us are striving to get rid of it. And then we feel shame upon shame when it's there. We're like, oh, you know, but that's why I word it this way, because I don't necessarily think that any of this goal is, even with the subconscious, let's wrap that back in. I have people ask me all the time, does this ever go away? We all want, I don't know if you or any of your listeners have ever watched The Eternal Sunshine or The Spotless Mind.
Yes.
That pill where, while that might be ideal for some people, I just don't think that's how life works.
Right.
Which that whether we're talking ego, whether we're talking inner child, whatever we're talking about, chances are the goal is integrated.
Yeah.
That's always going to be part of our existence, but how do we navigate that in a new way? How do we give ourselves conscious choice in those moments so that we can then start to get some new results?
Yeah. I just was going to say, I think it's so important to use gratitude to integrate how we can allow ego in our lives to, you know, better serve us. So just the fact that we, how much learning happens because of our ego, right? Like when we can sit here and witness what's going on in our brain.
What about like in terms of finding the quote unquote white, right person for us? How can we differentiate between intuition, like our intuitive knowing versus our ego?
Yeah, absolutely. So I get this question a lot in different versions, because the reality of it is we have feels, most of us, all day long. Mm-hmm. So it gets confusing to know the difference between what I call as a top-down feeling, which originated in a thought. If I think a thought long enough, as I think we all know, I can throw myself into complete panic just sitting here. Meanwhile, nothing's changed, you know, but I focused on the thought and now I'm having a whole visceral reaction in my body, which feels like a feeling to me, feeling nervous as hell, scared as hell, angry as hell, whatever it is, I'm feeling it real. I think we become complicated because when we talk about consciousness and why I'm such a proponent of it, I think very globally, all of us humans spend way too much time in our thinking mind and allowing our thinking mind to color our daily experiences, which leads us to a whole muddle ball of feelings that we can't differentiate, whether it's ego-based feeling or thought-based feeling or old narrative-based feeling or old trauma-induced feeling or intuition. So it's very complicated, and I do get this question a lot, which is the tool or what we need to develop is, I call it shaving away. We essentially need to shave away all of those top-down feelings. Mm. Each and every time we're coloring what's happening in our current environment with those past narratives, those past stories, right? Anytime we're bringing that in, anytime we're having that overactivation of our nervous system because it's, we're just overprimed in that fight or flight response, possibly for some of us based on trauma. This is why, again, back to this holistic approach, without doing that nervous system work to regulate our nervous system, we're always going to be hyperactive.
Yeah.
It's not going to relate for us. So we're coloring and we're having a lot of feel. So our goal is to get as grounded and as balanced in our body and to spend more and more time in that balanced, grounded place more often than not. But then we can, if we're so disconnected from our intuition, which some of us are, because we live our in our minds, literally, that makes all of our decisions for us. So some of us have to rebuild the connection and or some of us have to just learn to trust that connection. So as we get more and more connected to the intuition and we can differentiate, oh, I'm stressed out now because I'm doing that old worst case scenario thinking I do. This is not a real stress.
Yeah.
Right. That's different from, oh, this person I'm around is giving me a vibe that doesn't sit comfortably with me. Maybe I should exit this exchange. That's more intuitive. I assure you, like I said, we came here with that. We're not leaving. And I say this as well, because a concern that I hear often, well, if I just view life as it is and everyone is just okay and I accept everything, am I going to, this is understandable, am I going to be open for abuse or violation? Or am I going to lose my senses and walk into something that is actually threatening if I'm just throwing up peace sign? And my answer is always the same, no, absolutely not. Your intuition is still going to scream and yell in those moments and you're just going to be a bit clearer now to answer your question, differentiate and say, oh no, this is actually that deeper intuitive system putting on my brakes. Maybe I should listen to it.
You articulated that wonderfully. Thank you. I know you also specialize in boundaries. Why do some of us struggle so much with boundaries? And then why do some people push back on boundaries so much?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason I talk so often about boundaries, before I say to you that I think they're an incredibly important step of healing, is because I believe this is another universal. A lot of us weren't modeled boundaries at all, if not healthy ones. Particularly in our emotional worlds. What do I mean when I say that? A lot of us have gotten either direct or indirect messaging starting from a very young age that some aspect of us, our personality, how we're showing up in the world, what we're doing or we're not doing, affects someone else emotionally, which yes, objectively listeners, I say, yeah, that's true.
Like but codependency.
The more consistent we get that, you know, so even language like, oh, don't be loud, dad'll yell. Don't do that, mom will. The more consistently we hear that type of message, what we're actually hearing is some version of, I and responsible for someone else's feelings.
Wow.
And some of us hear that a lot more than others. So the reason I'm talking about it, and you say, you know, I don't know what you called me, an expert in it, but I come from a completely enmeshed, emotionally enmeshed, codependent household family. The feeling of one, my mother in particular, dictated the feeling of all, and everything orbited around how mom was feeling. When mom was feeling good, everyone was okay. And mom wasn't feeling good, everyone worried about how mom was feeling. And it was nothing outward. So my mom did not erupt, you know, when she was, but it was just ever present with similar messaging, what to do or not to do to make sure. So before I knew it, I started to show up in my relationships in that emotionally codependent way. And I share that often because I think a lot of us have that version of, it's beyond, when we think of codependency, we think a lot of just like, oh, I need someone to do something with or help me feel better. Yeah. It's that emotional, and sometimes it'll feel like, you know, roller coasters in a relationship.
Walking on eggshells.
It's doing good, I'm great. And when it's not doing good, I'm not great. And I think that's really prolific. So first and foremost, we have to get real clear with ourselves when we talk about boundaries. Again, I'm going to simplify the steps as I see it. To answer your question, I think we all struggle with boundaries in some way. Now as an adult, it's our job to put up shifts and changes in some of these dynamics. We have to start to show up differently in our relationships if we want our relationships to change.
Yes.
It's our tendency, I believe, back in this reality, go hand in hand a bit, is to say, oh no, you change and then I won't have to get mad or sad or whatever, right? But I don't believe that's empowered. I think our goal is, if we want the relationship to change, it's our responsibility to change it, which to answer your next question really simply, people don't like expectations violated, especially in those longer term relationships. We come to know, and we have a role now that we play, and typically is probably pretty consistent across all relationships, with how we show up. So when we decide to not show up in that way anymore, or to not show up at all, whatever our boundary is, or not to talk about that topic, I mean, boundaries look different for each of us depending on the relationship, that person is likely going to react in some way. At minimum, they're just going to be surprised to hear, right? And it's going to take a little bit of re-navigating a new dynamic. And at the more difficult extreme, it's not going to go over well. We're going to get some version of reactivity, emotional reactivity. So the three steps, going back to that, very simplified. The first step is to get clear within ourselves. If we are someone who struggles with boundaries, obviously identify that we do struggle and we need to change the way we're showing up, and to get clear on what changes that might need to be. And that's a process, because we don't know. A lot of us weren't modeled these type of boundaries, if any, in relationships.
Yeah.
So we might not be sure. Suggestions I give, I actually did a whole podcast with Melissa Hartwig of The Whole 30 on boundaries. So exploring, for a bit more information, if you guys are interested, you can pop over there. But for exploring, you know, what feels good, what feels bad, find the relationship where you feel kind of okay, what looks different there. That could help you define boundaries. Second step, enact them, communicate. This objective language is always going to be a great way to communicate, not throwing out, you did and you're crazy and you know, that's not going to help. Communicating at a time where you're not emotionally reactive, so not going to throw out the new boundary in the middle of an argument, but that doesn't prevent the third step then, which is maintaining the boundary, despite whatever version of pushback it is. It's not going to prevent the pushback. You can wait for the calmest day ever and word it in the most palpable way or so you think ever. And depending on the type of relationship or the person on the other side, you still might get a reaction. And that's why I say maintenance. I actually put that as a step because it's hard. And I know for me, what would then happen is the feel bad. I feel so guilty. Yeah. I feel terrible. Sometimes the person on the other side is telling me they're telling me all the reasons why I should feel that way. They're strengthening my reason. I'm selfish. I'm not right. So maintaining it is just as hard, and if not harder, and is, again, the way I view it, our responsibility.
We have a magic, respecting your boundary, because we know we only have 10 more minutes with you. We have a magic mom question. Patricia asks, I would love to start her free program she calls Future Self Journaling. Can you have her discuss the benefits of it?
Absolutely. So Future Self Journaling, for everyone out there, how to get it. It is actually comes free when you join my mailing list, and I believe on my link tree. So a nice and easy way to get it. So what Future Self Journaling is, it's something I developed. So I am not a person who's ever journaled in my life. So a bit of background. When I started to go on my own healing journey, I started to think about ways that I could use a journaling, a daily journaling habit, which for me would be new, to focus on change. Because I think a lot of times, and I think there's still a place for this type of journaling in our healing journeys, which is thinking about our past, getting our words out, maybe getting emotions down, free, you know, just free speaking, if you will, you know, free writing what happened during the day. There's a place for that. But I was really interested in, similar to the shift I was having in my therapy practice, if I just keep talking about how things were or are, I'm not really giving myself much space to think about how things could be. And I found that a limit. So I made a prompt that I now released called Future Self Journaling Prompts, as a way to use a daily journaling habit. So this is how it's helpful to A, just consistently remind myself that I'm working toward change. Mm-hmm. Because remember those two steps I said first, consciousness and then change. Mm-hmm. So without being daily conscious to the fact that, oh, right, I'm working on this new habit I want to break, or I want to do this new thing, or I want to think this new way. Over time, if we're not reminding ourselves daily, to put it really simply, we're going to go right back into that old pattern and we're not going to remember to make the changes. So the habit of writing, the habit of writing new future thoughts, our mind, this is what's beautiful about our mind. It does not know the difference between if it's real or if it's imagined. Yeah. So while you're sitting there and writing this new way of being, and maybe you have new affirmations, you know, where you're someone who thinks, a lot of us think this, I'm not enough, and you're writing, you are enough. You're actually firing up some new pathways. Yeah. And with the more consistent, there's that word again, repetition, we actually can retrain, we can lay down a new program, using the computer analogy, in our subconscious, but not without that consistent repetition. So while you're journaling, you're firing up, you're laying down some neural pathways, which then, like I said, equips you for later on in the day, beginning to practice. And the most, so I've now released this, you know, to anyone and everyone who's interested in journaling in this way. And the most impactful piece of it that I'm seeing people respond to is that daily consciousness. The fact that each day they're working toward a change equips them to see then more changes throughout their day, which is really cool. So anyone listening, it's free. It comes right to your inbox if you sign up for that email list. And like I said, I think there's a link on my link tree, but it's a great, it's a tool. They're like, I call all things. This is not magic. Yeah. It's not a magic journal. You don't get it, poof, write it, and bang, you're that person, right? Yeah. It just equips you to begin to make daily changes, which will get you to be that new person.
You still got to do the work.
Yeah.
All right. There's a few short questions we like to ask everyone who comes on the show. So first off, if you could hug your younger self right now, what would you say?
I would probably say that she's safe. Because I think for me, there was a lot of aspects of feeling really big feelings with not many people around. And one of my, like I shared earlier, one of my major anxieties as a child was bad things happening. And I don't, I actually know, I'm going to amend that. Not that I don't think, I know that my caregivers around me had little idea that all of that was even happening or a concern in my life. So I was very alone in that. So if I could have had someone, even adult me now, hugging me and just reminding me that I'm safe, I think that would have gone a really long way for me.
How old were you in that?
As long as I can remember. So I have very few memories, actual kind of picture-based memories of my childhood, because I believe I spent so much time not feeling safe enough, dissociated from two big feelings. That's how I coped with them. But from what I put together timeline wise, actually my sister, who's chronically ill, she's 15 years older than me. She had a pretty major surgery, though I don't remember this at all. Right where I was around three. And I know I was there because I went with my parents. We had to travel out of state. It was a very long, intensive surgery. So I think I was there for a long time. I don't have much detailed memory, but I'm sure that was probably a first really traumatic experience for me in not feeling safe and probably not having my parents as resources because they were caring for my sister at the time. So it might have even surpassed that. I mean, if you really want to go into it, my mom was very nervous with her pregnancy with me. She was 42 when she had me. And this was back when we were expecting me to have a diagnosis of Down syndrome or something, or, you know, so if we really want to go into it, if you're a believer in things being transmitted, you know, in utero, I actually would say, before I was even a person on the planet, that I did not feel safe because my mom was probably a Washington not navigating, worried about me in particular and my sister who's chronically ill in the background. I mean, so if we really want to answer that question, honestly, I think when I was a little nugget of sound, you know, like shit, man.
If you could have the whole world read one book, which would it be?
Oh, Whole World Ringworm book. So the book that always just comes to mind just because I think it's so amazing and beautiful. And it's very much in alignment with the way I think about energy is The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer.
So good.
Such a good one.
Yeah.
It is a good one. If you could whisper one phrase to everyone on the planet, what would it be?
You are enough. Because when I referenced that earlier, it comes to mind so frequently because we all have some version of that. And it doesn't mean that we didn't get accolades for some aspects of ourselves.
Right.
I do, like I said earlier, I do not believe a lot of us were seen and heard just for being the authentic being that we are. That is enough, period, at the end. And I think we all are desperately desiring.
We all need to hear it.
Hear that.
We need to put it on our mirrors, everybody.
You know what I mean? And then believe it in time. That's the next step of hearing it and then coming to actually believe that.
Yeah. I also feel like a lot of us are born into a circumstance that our parents were trying to heal something in their own relationship and we were supposed to be the mending thing. And so now, and we're not going to be able to do that for them. And so that starts us already off in this place of we're not enough.
Where can our listeners find you on the internet? And
yes, absolutely. So my main hub, though I have a few different hubs and I'm ever evolving, growing more, but my hub is on the Instagram account at the.holistic.psychologist. So pretty much anything going on, I run through there. The email list and link, I have a link tree, which is fairly new. So it helps people navigate around and get what they need, including signing up on that email list. I do have a YouTube channel, which is, you know, very new. Still, I actually just put a video out yesterday and the volume wasn't the best, but it's a work in progress. It's there. A video goes up every Sunday. It's a holistic psychologist, but video won't go up on there unless I've told you a video is going up on there through my Instagram as well. So I always direct people to Instagram. I have a website, yourholisticpsychologist.com, but all of it gets navigated quite easily as I think it through the Instagram account.
Yeah, we're huge fans of your Instagram already.
Your Instagram has been really, really healing for me.
Definitely instrumental.
Yes. I really appreciate you both saying that, Mercedes and Jade. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on with us. You're incredible. And I hope we get you on again sometime because we got many more questions.
Yeah.
I
got it. It's like a table of contents.
I love talking about this, so I could talk about it all the time. So I am not arguing. I love the mind. I've always loved it. Now that I know that there's more of us than the mind, I think it's just incredible. And having lived the journey and how much change is possible, I'm just so passionate that these tools get out there. So hearing that the two of you and everyone that's been impacted means the world to me, and I won't stop.
Well, we appreciate your work and thank you so much for being a light.
Of course. Yeah,
thank you.
Wow. I feel like it was a whirlwind of knowledge I was trying to absorb and question and figure out what else I need to know before she's gone.
I know.
Even though I could just go look at her page.
I had so many questions after all of her answers, but I was like, move on.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
I know.
It was pretty magical.
What it was our own practice and boundaries for sure.
I know. Seriously.
Respecting
seriously.
Other people's
I know. What's your magic trick today?
Oh, okay. My magic trick is to stop using overdramatic language to describe your current emotions. This is something I am terribly guilty of doing myself. And it's because when we use extreme language, or I think it's because when I use extreme language, it incites a larger response from whoever I'm talking to. So I feel like with the rise of social media and texting, all those things, came the rise of inauthentic emotional language because we aren't getting deep connection through a text or a comment. You know, we're just seeing the words on a screen with no micro expressions or energy to go along with it. And so the reason I think using overly dramatic language isn't the healthiest option is because it may lead to a difficulty expressing or communicating when something is actually dire and where dramatic language might actually be necessary. And I know this might seem like a silly or unnecessary effort to make in your life, but think about it and let it resonate if it makes sense for you. So if you want to try it with me, instead of saying things like, I hate that, or that's the worst, or even saying things like on the positive end, like she's the best, or that's crazy, or I'm crying or I'm dead. You know, when we talk about laughing on a text or something like that, I might say, oh my God, dead, or you're so crazy. or oh my God, you're killing me. If any of those things are real descriptions, then it's okay. But they're not going to be. So if you can use language that's actually in line with what you're describing, I think it'll help us all to better understand each other in a sense. And if you really want to challenge yourself with this, then you could even reply to people's texts with voice notes or videos when you want to show someone, you know, that you actually are having emotion in your response, whether it's positive or negative.
I actually love voice notes if they're just like simple voice notes. I'm like, why didn't you just text that? But I actually love voice notes when they are, you know, something that involves a little bit of vulnerability and intimacy.
Yeah, I think too, it depends on the person you're sending it to, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you need to be sending like your boss a voice note
right.
all the time.
No, but when it's a friend and you're not able to see that friend because you're such a busy single mom and you get to have that voice memo, it's almost like, you know.
It's like a little mini conversation without both of you having to be in the same spot.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm going to try it. Let you know how it turns out.
Okay, I'll try it with you.
Okay.
So mine is just a little simple, but something a lot of us probably don't think about is just like adult coloring mandalas, to be more specific. Mm. So mandalas as a form of meditation are actually entering medicine as a healing tool. There's an increasing body of clinical trials that suggest that it reduces stress, that it combats depression, that it reduces pain, it lowers blood pressure. I mean, the list goes on. And it also, they even say that it boosts the immune system and stimulates the release of melatonin, you know, which helps us, which, you know, slows cell aging and promotes sleep. So, they also say that it can help children deal with emotions and cope with illness. So in my mind, I think of my inner child, that it can be soothing for my inner child. There are a couple of cancer centers that even offer mandala workshops because of its healing benefits. And there was also, I was reading about how, you know, people who try to quit smoking, they take up knitting because they're trying to keep their hands busy and like their minds occupied, and it helps relieve stress. Well, this is even more powerful, coloring mandalas, because of all the other things that go into it. But I know for me, it helps me clear my mind because you're not thinking. You're, you know, focused on the page. It helps you to focus on the present and just achieve more mindfulness. And you are unplugging from technology while you're doing it, you know? So it promotes creation over consumption. and, you know, it also sparks creativity. So those are all the reasons why I would recommend coloring mandalas. I don't know if you remember when we first started this show, I was working on publishing my own adult coloring book where you are coloring basically your moods based off a color grid. And then we started the show, and I did not do that.
I got sidetracked.
That is something that I really, really want to do, because even just drawing out the designs for people to color was so meditative for me.
So
try it out. You can print one out offline, or you can buy one on Amazon. If mandalas doesn't really resonate with you, which you can look up all the healing benefits of even mandalas, but if that doesn't resonate with you, there are tons of adult coloring books of like really cool looking animals and stuff like that. So,
my mom colors mandalas a lot, actually, and she has them hung all over her office.
Yeah.
And it's even fun. I mean, this might sound like so goofy. I don't know who's listening and going, what the hell are y'all still talking about coloring mandalas? But not just the point of coloring it, but then you get to like have this little
There's
piece
one
of
behind
art
me.
That you kind of, yeah. That, you know, you get to have this little piece of art that you get to put on your wall or whatever. And with my mom, like, she has them all over her wall in her office, and so, you know, I'll go in there and I'll see the new ones that she's done, and I'll pick, you know, we'll talk about why this one's our favorite or why we like the colors in this scheme, and you know, it just adds to, I don't know, it's just something you did too, so I'll, somehow all of those things are beneficial. I like that a lot. And speaking of buying a coloring book on Amazon, before we sign off, I wanted to remind our Magic Mobbers that we're doing a little giveaway. Basically, all you have to do is leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. You can do it right now while you're listening to the show, actually. And once you've written your review, just snapshot it, post it on your Instagram, and tag our Instagram, which is @TheMagicHour, spelled MAJIC, so that we'll see it. And we'll be picking a couple winners each month to get a $100 Amazon gift card. Yeah, because we love you.
Cha-ching. All right, Magic Muppers, thank you so much for tuning in and taking this journey with us. If this episode held some magic for you, please share it with your friends and family. This one means so much to us. And don't forget to join us on our Instagram page at The Magic Hour and let us know what your favorite episodes have been so far. We appreciate all your feedback and want to know what is currently lighting you up.
Yes, and by the way, we release a new episode every Monday, so you can catch us again next week or go listen to some of our podcast episodes, our past episodes in our podcast library now. We will meet you there. Until then,
be a light. Big thank you to @RaytoneRoyal for our intro jam and to John Aaron Garza from Real In Motion Productions for producing the show. Stay magical, friends.
Quick disclaimer. We are not medical professionals, so following any of our protocols or advice should be done at your own risk, people. And please remember to always, always do your own research. Tap into that extraordinary growth mindset we all have access to within ourselves and seek out your own answers. Come on, guys, you know the deal. And by the way, if you are a medical professional or an expert in any topic we cover and you feel we are not giving accurate information about it, please find somewhere to contact us. Contact us via social or email us at our website and let us know. A major goal of ours in doing this podcast is to bring value to people's lives by sharing helpful insights and info. So we welcome being corrected at any time, and we'll be happy to share any of our fuck-ups with our listeners so as to get us all back on track to discovering our happiest, healthiest selves.